Having a teen feels like having your own live-in influencer. Somehow you know the latest makeup trend and the fact that skinny jeans are not the most flattering pants. Now it's time for you to show them what's up, thanks to Domino's. From April 22nd through April 28th, carry out as many large two-topping pizzas from Domino's as you want for only $6.99 each. And teach your kiddo that saving money and Domino's pizza will never go out of style. Carry out only. You must ask for this limited time offer. Valid 422 through 428. Tax may apply. Prices, participation, and charges may vary.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun. And that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
The first degree.
These things are supposed to happen in movies, not in real life.
The guy himself was very strange. So it was kind of one of those things where it's like, I mean, you're surprised if anybody does anything like that. But I was like, oh, yeah, that guy. The only thing that really surprised me was like, oh, my God, I know him.
Welcome to The First Degree, the true crime podcast that you might end up on. My name is Jack Vanek. I'm sitting here with Alexis Linkletter. It's another Wednesday. Happy Wednesday, our friends.
Happy Wednesday, everyone.
Happy Wednesday, everyone. I don't know if I've given our little Patreon shout out in a while, so I'm going to do the little spiel. I won't waste your time. It'll be fast. But if you're looking for more First Degree content, if you've listened to all of our episodes from the very beginning, number one, we apologize because the beginning ones were
a little rough. We were starting out.
A little rough.
From scratch.
But if you've listened to everything and you want more, please join us on Patreon. We have one bonus episode every single week for you, full true crime episodes that you send us in. We are kind of listener submitted over there. So any case that you want us to do a deep dive into, that's what we're there for.
That's right.
All right. Well, is that enough of that?
I think that's enough of that.
Whew, let's turn down the lights.
And turn up your anxiety.
Because this could be you.
In life, there's this strange intuition we all possess, like a silent alarm that goes off when something just doesn't feel right. You've probably encountered someone before and thought, there's something off about them. And later, you're not surprised in the least when you find out they've done something wrong. Today, we're diving into a chilling case that explores this very phenomenon, that gut feeling when you sense someone is just off, and it's no shock when you discover they're capable of unthinkable acts, even murder.
So today's case begins on Saturday, January 3rd of 2009. So we're only 3 days into the new year at this point. The number one song in the charts was Single Ladies by Beyoncé, obviously such a classic. And other tracks included T.I.'s Live Your Life and Lady Gaga's Just Dance. The number one movie in theaters, I'm still upset that I ever saw this movie, was Marley and Me. It's one of the saddest movies in the world. And
traumatizing movie.
Why did they make it?
That was on every airplane for like ever.
I watched it on an airplane.
You just wander over to it because there's a cute dog and then it's a regret.
It's a regret. I don't know if I ever told you, but I did watch it on an airplane and then the seat directly in front of me was also watching it, but they were like 10 minutes ahead of me. So no. Like I could see what was going to happen and I was like, this is actual torture.
Hell.
Why are we doing this to ourselves?
I don't know.
So other movies included Bedtime Stories with Adam Sandler and The Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
And the setting for today's case is College Station, Texas, which is located around 100 miles outside of two major Texas cities, Austin and Houston. College Station is home to the main campus of Texas A&M University. And in case you didn't know, the A&M stand for Agricultural and Mechanical, which I did not know. Today, more than 10% of the city's 120,000 residents work for the university. And our first degree for today's case is Frankie. And in the very early 2000s, she was attending college at Texas A&M. She actually lived in a house in Bryan, which is located right next to College Station.
We were actually living in downtown Bryan. We were living in this like really cool old house that was straight up haunted, but it was a really neat little place.
Frankie shared the house with four roommates, and one of those roommates was a woman we're going to call Rose. Rose was the only roommate who wasn't in college, and she was also the only roommate with a grown-up job. She worked for the CPS.
She was very normal. She was super sweet. She had already graduated from, you know, like A&M. She was the only one in our house that had like a normal job. Like I was a bartender, you know, I think one of the other girls was just going to school full time. One of them was like a personal fitness instructor.
So all of the roommates were women except for one. And his name was Chris. And he and Frankie actually shared a room together. But he wasn't the only Chris around in this friend group. The roommates had a bunch of friends named Chris, so they all gave the Chris's nicknames. Frankie's roommate Chris was gay, so they lovingly called him Gay Chris. There was a Chris with sideburns, so he became Sideburns Chris, and so on and so forth.
Then, if you can believe it, another Chris entered the mix when Rose began dating another guy named Chris.
I honestly can't remember the first time I actually met him. It could have been that brought him over to the house one day. When we were all hanging out, we used to throw parties there all the time. So it could have been in one of those situations. I just remember suddenly he was there, she's dating him, and he looked normal. He seemed normal. I say this with love because like my best friend is an IT guy, but he looks like he works in IT or something, or he looks like a kind of a smart, sleazy, whatever kind of used car salesman. I mean, he's tall, short, brown hair, blue eyes. Not handsome, you know what I mean? I mean, he's not ugly, but he's just not good looking.
At first, Rose's new boyfriend, Chris, didn't have a nickname, but that would soon change. One night, Frankie, Rose, and Chris went to a football tailgate party with a big group of friends. While out, Frankie met a guy that she kind of started vibing with. Eventually, that guy, Frankie, and the rest of the group went to a nearby bar called The Chicken.
And while they were at the Chicken, Chris noticed that the guy Frankie was vibing with was wearing black nail polish on his pinky finger and ring finger. Honestly, a guy that I would be into back in the day.
Totally.
But for some reason, Chris didn't like this nail polish at all. He confronted the guy and asked, "What the hell is that?" The guy responded something like, "Nothing, man, it's whatever," like trying to like diffuse the situation. But Chris was not letting it go.
He's like, "Well, you need to scrape that off your fingernails." And the guy was like, "What? What do you mean?" You know, and anyway, he like pulls out his knife and flips it open and kind of like points it at him and says, "You need to get that off your fingernails before I cut your fingers off." And that was the moment we were all like, "Wait, what?" Kind of like a record scratch. Like, what was that for?
From that point on, Rose's boyfriend was known to the whole group as Psycho Chris.
Frankie wasn't 100% sure why Psycho Chris decided to act all, I don't know, psycho at the bar, but she thought it could be because he was trying to be your typical macho Texas guy.
He was kind of nerdy, but it seemed like he tried to give off that vibe. You know, like I've met a ton of guys like this, you know, like, "Oh, I'm Mr. Got My Stuff Together. I know what's best, you know, do what I say." This 1950s patriarchal, you know, whatever kind of vibe.
Going off on the guy with nail polish wasn't the only time Frankie saw Psycho Chris act like, well, a total psycho. One night, she and another roommate were hanging out in the living room playing video games. Rose was in her bedroom sleeping. Earlier, she'd come home from work and said she was exhausted and needed to sleep. She specifically mentioned that she didn't want to be disturbed for the rest of the night. So when Chris called and asked to speak with Rose that evening, Frankie told him that she was sleeping and wasn't taking any calls.
I was like, "Look, she's knocked out. I don't think she wants to be bothered, but, you know, I'll let her know that you called when she wakes up." And he was kind of pissed off about that. I got off the phone with him. I remember telling her, I was like, because it was kind of weird. I was like, "Hey, girl, I don't mean to bother you, but your boyfriend or whatever just called." And she was like, "No, I don't want to deal with him. He wants to hang out or something. I don't want to do that." She went back to sleep or, you know, I shut the door. And then he like called again. It was really weird. Like, "No, man, she's asleep. Like, leave her alone." And then like, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 minutes later, he just walks in our front door. No knocking on the door, nothing. He just walked in like he lived there. And we're all like, "What the hell?" He's like, "Oh, hey, what are you guys doing?" We're like, "Oh, hanging out. What are you doing?" And anyway, he was like, "Well, I'm going to go see..." And we're just like, "Okay." And he just walked back down the hallway to her bedroom and barged in the door. I didn't hear any yelling or anything. I think he He definitely woke her up, and I guess they hung out. Like, she didn't push him out of the house.
Frankie felt like Psycho Chris didn't really have any boundaries, and he was exhibiting abusive and controlling behavior toward Rose.
That's the way I saw it. I mean, he could have been suspicious in the sense that, you know, like, is she really asleep or is she just blowing me off? And that's something he couldn't handle. Like, I don't think he didn't think she was home or that we were covering for her. I think he was just like, no, I want to hang out with her and she's going to have to hang out with me. And when it was like, you know, no, she's not going to talk on the phone, it was like, well, then I'm coming over here and I'm going to make her talk to me. Really weird.
After the barging in unannounced incident, Rose talked about breaking up with Chris, but they never did break up. And he stuck around, hanging out at the house Frankie was sharing with Rose.
Frankie witnessed other concerning situations involving Psycho Chris, but here's the thing. He wasn't weird or psycho all of the time. In fact, for the most part, he really seemed to treat Rose well. So Frankie wasn't super worried about Rose's safety. She played off this weird behavior just as being super socially awkward or, I don't know, something like that.
Eventually, in or around the year of 2002, Frankie moved out of the house, and her relationships with all of her roommates, including Rose, just naturally drifted apart.
I had started, like, playing music. And at the place that I bartended at, it was a live music venue. And I met and made really good friends with one of the bands there. And I ended up moving in with that band, which is why I moved out of the house. And I got super involved with that and music and everything. I don't even know why I didn't hang out with them anymore. It wasn't as easy as it is now. Like, no social media, no one has a cell phone. You really have to want to hang out with someone. You got to call them up and then hope they're home so they answer, type thing. So it just kind of organically went away. You know what I mean? Like, the friendship just kind of, like, fizzled. All of them did.
Around a year after the roommates went their separate ways, Frankie ran into her friend, Sideburns Chris, at the mall. He told her some super shocking news. Rose and Psycho Chris had gotten married.
I ran into Sideburns Chris at the mall like a year later, and he was like, oh my God, I actually, you know, just came from their wedding. And I was like, she married Psycho Chris? Are you serious? Like, why? And he tried to, like, I don't know, like, play it down. Like, I guess they were all still close. And he's like, you know, like, she's happy. So, you know, like, maybe we don't, he didn't say it, but I got the impression. It was like, maybe we don't call him Psycho Chris anymore. And I was like, oh, you know, okay, well, I'm glad, you know, wish him all the best.
On the inside, Frankie was thinking how surprised she was that Rose had married someone she had previously talked about breaking up with. Someone who had exhibited behavior that literally earned him the nickname Psycho Chris.
Around a year after Frankie ran into Sideburns Chris and found out that Rose had married Psycho Chris, Frankie actually ran into Rose herself at a bar. Rose told Frankie that she and Chris got married and actually had a child together.
It was fun. She seemed happy, but, you know, it was New Year's. I didn't see Psycho Chris. He wasn't, like, with her when I ran into her. He may have been, like, on the other side of the bar or something. So I didn't, like, talk to him. Literally, the last time I saw that guy was at the house we lived at. I never saw him again. But I saw at that point on that New Year's.
After New Year's, Frankie didn't see or hear anything about Rose for years. You know, time just goes by faster and faster. But then, on January 3rd, 2009, Frankie got a call from a friend telling her about something horrible that had happened while he was out with friends the night before.
My friend called me up and was like, holy crap, you're not going to believe this. I was just over at Poets last night, and one of the guys that I was hanging out with, he got shot behind Poets. I was just like, wow, what do you know? What happened?
Frankie's friend explained that he and his friend, Rufus Stevens, had gone to Poets Billiards in College Station the night before. After the friend left for the night, Rufus was found shot in his truck. The friend wasn't sure who killed Rufus, but he did mention that there had been a creepy guy at the bar, and he thought maybe this creepy guy could be the killer.
And it wasn't long after this conversation that Rufus's killer was arrested. Frankie's friend immediately recognized him as the creepy guy from the bar. And when Frankie saw who the killer was, she also recognized him.
I was like, oh my God, I know him. That's Psycho Chris.
Sadly, when Frankie saw a picture of Rufus, she realized that she also knew him as well, though not to the same level that she knew Psycho Chris. She'd never hung out with Rufus before, but she'd run into him over the years since her friend group and his group mingled together and kind of crossed over a bit. and she also knew Rufus from the bar that he worked at.
So how in the world did Psycho Chris go from just yelling at guys about their fingernail polish to shooting Rufus behind a bar? Why did Chris kill Rufus? And had Chris always been violent? And Frankie and Rose just didn't know it? To answer these questions and more, you know the drill. We gotta go back.
Christopher Keith Schmotzer, a.k.a. Psycho Chris, was born on February 22, 1972 in Harris County, Texas. There really isn't much known about his childhood, but we do know at the start of 1992, he was 19 years old and living in Houston with his girlfriend, who we're going to call Stacy. And although they were still teenagers, the couple married that same year because Stacy was pregnant with twin girls.
Soon after the twins were born, Stacy learned that Chris didn't really have any patience. Unfortunately, the twins had colic and cried almost constantly, as babies are to do, frankly. Chris apparently could not handle this and would often yell at the babies and tell them to shut up, which babies don't speak English.
Oh my God. So that wasn't all. One day, Stacy came home to find that Chris had taped a pacifier into one of the girls' mouths so he could play Nintendo in another room. At some point after this, Stacy left because she was afraid Chris would hurt the children, and good for her.
And after Stacy divorced Chris, his behavior seemed to escalate. He had a brief intimate relationship with a man in 1997, and they lived together for 6 months. So this is like a kind of abrupt pivot here. That man later testified that on two occasions during their time together, Chris came home drunk and physically abused him. During one incident, the man was thrown to the ground and choked after Chris accused him of messing with or losing one of his jackets. That's unreal.
Yeah. Then in 2000, Chris was arrested after an altercation with a female neighbor. This neighbor later testified that during the incident, Chris nearly broke down her door in a drunken rage when she parked in his parking spot outside of their duplex. The neighbor said that she tried to explain to him that she would move her car the next morning, but at this point, Chris didn't care. She said, "I could see something change in his face, and I could tell I was in danger."
I gotta say, though, obviously there's something wrong with Chris, but maybe the only time I've been enraged since I've lived in LA is when neighbors park in my parking spot or block me into my parking spot. Like, there's just something about that that's pretty upsetting.
Yeah, I know.
And especially if someone then told me, like, no, I'm not going to move it till morning, I would go berserk, personally.
You wouldn't do what Chris did, but you understand the rage.
Desire for rage, yeah.
Yes.
So as a result, this neighbor called the police, but Chris drove off before they arrived. And a College Station police officer tracked him down and arrested him for driving drunk. He was later convicted and sentenced to probation and community service.
At some point after the DUI conviction, Chris met Rose and, by proxy, our first-degree Frankie. Frankie told us she isn't sure if Rose knew anything about Chris's concerning past, and she finds it unlikely since Rose was working for CPS and would have known that obviously taping a pacifier to a baby's mouth is a massive red flag.
Rose and Chris married in the fall of 2002. They went on to welcome two children together, one in 2004 and another in 2008. Rose continued working for the CPS while Chris worked as a car salesman. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options and more than 60 add-ons every week. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for all of your springtime goals. If you don't have time, Factor's ready-to-eat meals are on the table in 2 minutes. So you just get to eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, cleaning up. You really just heat and savor the good stuff without all of the stress. You can customize your weekly meals with as much or as little as you need. Plus, you can pause and reschedule your deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution to premium, fast meals without the need for cooking. And they're celebrating Earth Day all month long. So look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for their lowest carbon footprint meals. I'm so busy, so it's amazing to just have Factor meals in the fridge for whenever I realize that I'm starving and I don't have any time to cook anything. They're amazing, they're healthy, and they keep you fueled all day long. Head to factormeals.com/degree50 and use code degree50 to get 50% off your first month, plus 20% off your next month. That's degree50 at factormeals.com/degree50. 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Hey, there's no reason to feel sad or guilty about the things you aren't using anymore. Whether it was a fancy dress you wore to a gala, expensive heels that only go with one of your outfits, or that crossbody bag from when you were in your music festival era. Somebody out there wants what you don't, and the RealReal makes it easy to get it to them. When your past becomes their future, everyone wins, especially the planet. For the RealReal, Earth Month isn't just another month. It's what they do every day. At any given moment, they're finding new homes for over 1 million unique items within their community of 35 plus million people. They're the largest luxury reseller in the world and making a tangible difference towards a more sustainable future for fashion. Resale reduces the amount of fashion waste in landfills, lowers greenhouse gas emissions, and offers an alternative to the cycle of consumption propagated by fast fashion. The RealReal has kept over 37 million items in circulation and out of landfills. This month only, new shoppers get 20% off when they shop on therealreal.com using code FIRST. That's therealreal.com using the code FIRST.
On January 2nd, 2009, Chris and Rose got a sitter for their children, who are now 4 years and 6 months old. They met up with some friends at Poets. They drank and played darts.
It was a Friday night, so there were lots of other people at Poets, including Rufus Stevens. He was a regular at Poets, and on the night of January 2nd, he went to play darts and shuffleboard with his friend Will, and Frankie's friend, the one who later called to tell her about Rufus's murder.
William Rufus Stevens Jr. was born on November 26, 1979. His dad was a wildlife biologist with Texas Parks and Wildlife, so it only really makes sense that he instilled a love for the outdoors in Rufus. They often spent summers fishing on the War Eagle Creek in Arkansas, and this was really their ultimate happy place.
Rufus was so dedicated to the outdoors that as an adult, he decided to enroll in Texas A&M to study wildlife and fisheries science. In December of 2008, he graduated with his bachelor's degree. He then lined up a job, which was going to start after Rufus went to Hawaii at the end of January of 2009. Unfortunately, he never did get to take that trip or start his new job.
On the night of January 2nd, Rufus went to Poets with his friends, and like we talked about before, in a different group, Psycho Chris, Rose, and their friends were also there as well. We asked Frankie to describe the inside of Poets so we could get a better understanding of where Rufus and his friends were in regards to Chris and his friends group.
It's kind of broken up into two sections. There's one section that is nothing but pool tables, and you've got to go down a couple of steps. It's kind of like a sunken-in area, and it's just that, pool tables. When you first walk in, either the front or the back, you're like right where the bar is, and it's a pretty big bar. And around that bar, like by the front door, there's a lot of tables. There's a stage there. So when we played, that's where we would play and people would watch. But also next to that area, like also in that same area, is a few dart boards. There's a shuffleboard. Yeah, that's pretty much it. So the way I pictured it when I was told about this is that Rufus and my friend and their crew were probably over by the dartboards and the shuffleboard and hanging out over there, like standing up and doing their thing. And it sounds like Psycho Chris and his people were maybe sitting at one of the tables in the front, which is near it, but not like right up on it.
After a few hours at Poets, Rose went home to relieve their babysitter. Chris remained at the bar with his friend. And when that friend left, Chris decided to stay there by himself. I guess he just wanted to keep drinking until close.
At one point, a bar employee, who was in charge of kicking people out if need be, noticed Chris staring at Rufus and his group of friends. The employee thought that there might be a fight, kind of brewing, so he decided to keep a close eye on Chris. The employee watched Chris for the rest of the night, but he never got physical with anybody. He did act confrontational, though, as if he was looking for a fight.
At one point, Chris seemingly tried to start something with a guy in Rufus's group who supposedly had his pants sagging. Chris stopped the guy and asked, "Do your pants have belt loops?"
And the guy's like, "Yeah." And he goes, "Well, why don't you put on a belt, pull up your pants or whatever, because it's disrespectful. Be a man, and your group needs to stop acting like they run the place." Chris kind of went back and forth between being angry and rude about it to apologetic. kind of like, you know, man, I'm just saying, you know, it's just good advice or whatever type of vibe. But then also like going back to being angry again. And the guy was like, it was really weird.
This sounds a lot like the nail polish incident. If Chris thinks someone is doing something they shouldn't, he's going to stop them and say something, apparently.
Throughout the night, Chris continued staring at Rufus and his group of friends, but he never started anything physical. The employee in charge of kicking people out was relieved when 2 a.m. came around and no fights had broken out. Everybody left the bar and the staff began clearing up.
At around 2:30 a.m., a bar manager for a different bar in the same shopping center as Poets went outside to take the trash out at the end of the night. While doing that, he saw a man hanging out of the driver's side door of a parked truck.
He was like, oh, a drunk, whatever, and went back inside. Because that happens a lot. And then he'd shut down the bar and he came out for the last time. He was going to his vehicle and the car door was still open. And he was like, okay, maybe I'm going to like check this out. And he went and looked and that's when he realized, oh my God.
There was a pool of dark blood underneath a man who was hanging outside the door. Obviously, something was terribly wrong. The man wasn't drunk. He was badly hurt. The manager went back inside and grabbed a waitress and they approached the truck together. The manager shined a flashlight inside the truck and saw Rufus Stevens slumped out of the open driver's side door, still wearing his seatbelt.
He was unconscious, covered in blood, and breathing erratically. The waitress ran inside and called 911. It was now 3:30 a.m., around an hour after the manager had first gone outside to take the trash out.
First responders quickly arrived and rushed Rufus to the hospital where he was treated for a gunshot wound to the side of his head. Unfortunately, he was not able to be saved.
Homicide detectives showed up at Poets and immediately started processing the scene for evidence. The lead detective, Detective Arnold, found a bullet hole in the passenger's door of Rufus's truck and a .40 caliber shell casing near the rear driver's side tire. Whoever had killed Rufus did not clean up before leaving.
The police didn't have any suspects yet, so Detective Arnold interviewed multiple people who had been at the bar and asked if anything suspicious had happened. Everyone, except for the people with Rufus, said that they hadn't noticed anything out of the ordinary.
Rufus's friend Will told Detective Arnold that a white man wearing a blue shirt, light pants, and tan loafers had been staring intently at their group the entire night. Will wasn't sure who this man was, but a waitress was able to identify him as Chris Schmotzer, a.k.a. Psycho Chris. Detective Arnold asked Will if Rufus interacted with Chris at any point during the night, and Will said no. However, Will had actually spoken to Chris after he approached him and asked about the name on the back of Will's jersey, which belonged to Washington Capitals star Alexander Ovechkin.
Chris told Will that he played World of Warcraft with somebody who had the same last name as the back of Will's jersey. Chris asked Will if he played World of Warcraft as well. Will said no, the name on the back of his jersey belonged to a hockey player, not a video game player. After this, the conversation ended kind of awkwardly and Chris just sort of walked away. He continued staring at Rufus and his group for the rest of the night.
Will told Detective Arnold that when the bar closed at 2 a.m., he gave Rufus a ride to his truck, which was in the back parking lot. And after parking next to Rufus's truck, they got out of Will's car and stood in the lot and talked a little bit. That's when Will realized that Chris was there too. He was standing next to a truck, which was parked next to a light pole. Chris just stood there, staring at Will, as if he hated him with a fiery passion.
Will and Rufus decided to throw around a football in the parking lot, and while they were doing this, Chris just continued staring at them.
He goes out and just stares at the two guys while they're playing football, living their best life, you know, like enjoying themselves. And he just stood out there and stared. I even read the testimony of the guy that was out there playing football with him. He said that at one point, though, I don't know if he didn't catch the ball and ended up kind of like rolling close to where Chris was. And he went over and said something to him, picked up the ball, which is like, oh, hey, man, sorry about that. He said that Chris stared at him like he was the worst human being on planet Earth. Like he hated him. And the guy said, I've never seen anybody look at me like that. He said it was messed up.
Will told Detective Arnold that after playing football for around 15 minutes, he and Rufus decided to call it a night. Will got in his car and he drove off, and he had no idea that Rufus had never made it out of the parking lot. But what he did know is that Chris was still standing there, staring at him when he left.
After meeting with Will, Detective Arnold viewed surveillance videos from the bar and the liquor store next door, and all of the footage corroborated Will's story. At 2:18 a.m., Will's silver car pulled up next to Rufus's truck in the parking lot. Around 11 minutes later, they could be seen throwing a football near the two cars. They played for 13 minutes, and then Will's car exited the parking lot. Then the back light of Rufus's truck turned on, but didn't move.
Detective Arnold would later learn why Rufus didn't immediately drive off. He was actually texting with a new love interest.
This is like a tearjerker. He was texting her, and they had made plans to hang out that night to go see a movie or something. So he may not have even have been there if everything worked out the way it was supposed to. But I think something fell through, like she had to work or something. And so she ended up texting him later on. And that's who he was texting back in the truck. She had texted him and he didn't respond. And she wrote back again, was like, hello, and he didn't respond because he had been shot at that point. He had actually typed out a text, wasn't even able to send it yet. It was something sweet, hey, yeah, I miss seeing you. Or it was something really nice that he was in the middle of texting.
While Rufus was typing out this really, really sweet message, a gunman walked up to Rufus's truck and shot him.
He walked up to him, completely blindsided him. The way he was shot was toward the back of his head, the driver's side part. And I think the gun expert said that he was shot from at least 6 inches away.
The surveillance footage of the shooting was grainy, but Detective Arnold could see that the shooter was wearing light pants. After shooting Rufus, the gunman then walked away from Rufus's truck and got into a red four-door truck parked in the corner of the parking lot. That truck then drove away. Since Will had told Detective Arnold that the creepy staring guy, aka Psycho Chris, had been wearing light-colored pants, Arnold believed that this gunman could be Chris.
Having a teen feels like having your own live-in influencer. Somehow you know the latest makeup trend and the fact that skinny jeans are not the most flattering pants. Now it's time for you to show them what's up, thanks to Domino's. From April 22nd through April 28th, carry out as many large two-topping pizzas from Domino's as you want for only $6.99 each. And teach your kiddo that saving money and Domino's pizza will never go out of style. Carry out only. You must ask for this limited time offer. Valid 4/22 through 4/28. Tax may apply. Prices, participation, and charges may vary.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
On the afternoon of January 3rd, 2009, Detective Arnold went to Chris's house to speak with him. But Chris was at work, but his wife, Rose, was home. Arnold asked if Chris had been at Poets the night before, and Rose explained that yes, they had both been there together. When asked what Chris was wearing, Rose said a dark t-shirt, khaki pants, and light-colored loafers. Arnold then asked if Chris played World of Warcraft and drove a red four-door truck. Rose confirmed yes, he did. Arnold asked if Chris carried a gun, and Rose said yes. He always kept a handgun in his truck.
At this point, Detective Arnold was almost positive Chris was the shooter responsible for Rufus's senseless murder. So he and another detective went to Chris's work to speak with him. Chris confirmed that he was at Poets the night of the murder. He said he got there around 8 p.m., had 6 or 7 drinks, and left around 2 a.m. When asked if he saw men throwing a football around in the parking lot, he said he did see that, but he didn't talk to the players or watch them play.
Arnold asked if Chris kept a gun in his truck, and Chris said yes, it was a .40 caliber. Arnold then let Chris know that that was the same kind of gun used in the shooting of Rufus. He also revealed to Chris that he found a video of him leaving the bar parking lot at around 2:40 a.m., not 2 a.m., like Chris had claimed. Arnold told Chris, "I feel like you aren't telling me everything, and I feel that way because we have that video."
Detective Arnold asked Chris if he could take his gun in for testing, and surprisingly, Chris said yes. He led detectives out to his truck and showed him the handgun and .40 caliber ammunition located in the back seat. The handgun and ammunition were taken into evidence and sent off for testing.
And at this point, Detective Arnold was really certain that Chris was the killer. However, he wasn't arrested right away. They waited until around 10 p.m. that night to take him into custody and charge him with murder.
When our first-degree Frankie heard about Psycho Chris being arrested for murdering someone, she wasn't exactly shocked.
The guy himself was very strange. So it was kind of one of those things where it's like, I mean, you're surprised if anybody does anything like that, but I was like, oh yeah, that guy. The only thing that really surprised me was like, oh my God, I know him.
Frankie also thought a lot about Rose, who is still married to Chris, and what she could be going through.
Is such a nice person. I couldn't believe it. You're thinking about what is she going through? What is she thinking? What is she doing? They've got kids, you know, like there was a lot of emotions going on there.
Although Chris was now in custody, the investigation wasn't over yet. They still had to officially confirm that Chris's gun really was the murder weapon. It wasn't long before ballistics testing on Chris's gun proved that it was indeed the gun used to kill Rufus. At this point, the police were positive Chris killed Rufus, but they weren't sure why. They continued interviewing people who'd been at Poets, hoping to answer that question, but they never found any connection between Rufus and Chris. In fact, no witnesses could even recall ever seeing them talk throughout that night.
He had no beef with Rufus. They hadn't even spoken to each other the entire night. They had zero interaction. Like, he had talked to three people from that group, and none of them were Rufus.
Chris's trial began in late June of 2010. Prosecutors told the jury that they were unable to find that connection between Rufus and Chris. They weren't sure why Chris decided to kill Rufus, but what they did know was that his murder was cold-blooded and unprovoked. The prosecution pointed out that Chris had a history of violence. He had beaten or attempted to assault people in the past over really minor disputes, a lost jacket, and a parking space, just to name a few.
The prosecution tried to get Rose to testify, but she declined, which was her right since she was still married to Chris.
She did not testify. She had to show up. She said, you know, whatever, answered a couple of questions, you know, like, are you the wife of Psycho Chris or whatever? And she answered yes. And then she turned around and got the hell out of the courtroom and didn't even look at him.
The defense presented no witnesses or evidence. Instead, they simply told the jury that the prosecution's case was circumstantial. They had no proof that Chris fired the murder weapon, and their surveillance footage wasn't clear enough to prove that Chris was the one walking away from Rufus's truck.
During closing arguments, the prosecution told the jury that Chris was guilty as hell. They said there's a better chance of winning the lottery at 125 million to one than Chris not being guilty of murdering Rufus.
During the defense team's closing arguments, they reiterated that there was no evidence proving Chris was guilty. They also claimed that the prosecution didn't come up with a motive or reason for Chris to kill Rufus. The prosecution fought back against this claim in their rebuttal statement. They told the jury that Chris's motive for killing Rufus was fueled by alcohol, testosterone, and who knows what else.
It should come as no surprise that the jury took less than an hour to find Chris guilty of murdering Rufus. Next up was the penalty phase, where the jury would decide what sentence Chris would receive. The prosecution argued he should receive the maximum, which was life, while the defense asked for the jury to show Chris mercy.
During this phase, the prosecution had Chris's first wife, Stacy, testify about Chris's treatment of their children. She described being so scared that Chris was going to hurt their children that she left him.
Rose also testified during the penalty phase. She painted a completely different picture of Chris than Stacy had. Rose described him as an amazing, amazing father to their two children. She said, "He is a very strong man, and he loved me for me, and I loved him for him. He made me laugh, and we just clicked." When asked if she still loved him, Rose said yes.
During this phase, Rufus's father took the stand and talked about how Rufus loved the outdoors and dreamed of being an environmental lawyer, about how Rufus frequently fished and hunted, and he paid his own way through college. He said that Rufus's death had been a tremendous loss. "He is my son, and I won't get to see him get married. I won't have grandchildren. We can't go on trips. We can't watch football games." It was a devastating testimony to listen to.
Other families spoke about Rufus. They talked about his love for sports, fishing, canoeing, and his Labrador retriever. One of his aunts said he believed his life had purpose, and he was eager to pursue and fulfill that purpose. Our families love Rufus. We will miss him. We always will.
I listened to Rufus's family talk, and even my friend was like, God, he was such a good dude. Like, why? Why this guy? You know, like, why would you pick on him? It was just like, God, I hope they fry this guy. Like, what a worthless human being. Like, Rufus had, like, just graduated from the university. He graduated in a field that I think his dad was part of also. He had a job lined up.
The jury only took 12 minutes to determine that Chris should receive life in prison, although he will be eligible for parole after serving 30 years.
Even though Chris was behind bars for at least 30 years, there were still many unanswered questions. The main one being, why? Why in the world would Chris kill Rufus? Frankie has a theory.
My theory is Chris has always been an insecure guy. I think he probably doesn't understand his desires, you know, and with the whole possibly being bisexual, especially like the age he is, that wasn't as widely accepted. And that probably confused him, pissed him off. I'm sure he probably had a lot of things in his background that didn't make him feel, like super assured about his role in the world in general. And he figured that, I don't know, like being this 1950s, you know, I'm the guy you can rely on. I'm the guy who knows what's going on. I'm a leader type thing is like who he wanted to be. But in reality, he wasn't. I think he's got a very short fuse and like emotionally immature. And I think he saw a bunch of guys that were hanging out. Like Rufus himself was a big, attractive, you know, guy who was comfortable in his own skin. And I think that's the exact opposite how Chris, you know, like felt in his life. And I think he was jealous. And I think he was angry that he couldn't be, you know, that guy. And I think he probably sees there's a lot of, you know, like, especially around that time, there were a lot of guys that were like that, you know, like these big football player looking laid back, you know, good looking kids around here because it is a college town. And, you know, I don't know if it's like he's getting older and he just feels like, man, that's not me and I wish it was. And that just kind of between the alcohol, because I heard he was like really drunk and I heard other people testify that, you know, he could be a really nice guy and then all of a sudden he would just snap. Maybe that's what happened. I even heard that maybe he got the two guys mixed up and he thought he was shooting the guy with the jersey on because the guy with the jersey was the one that was playing football with Rufus. So maybe he got the wrong guy. He just, you know, was drunk and angry and jealous and insecure.
After the trial was over, Rose filed for divorce from Chris. A few years later, Frankie actually ran into Rose because both of their children were attending the same elementary school.
We ran into each other at a parent-teacher orientation for our kindergartners. I guess it's her second child and my second child. And she, like, called me over. She was sitting behind me, and she was like, you know, Frankie. And I was like, who is calling me? And I turned around, and it was and I was like, oh, my God. Oh, shit. Okay, what do I do? You know, because this is awkward. Like, I didn't want to say anything that would make her feel uncomfortable, like, oh, I heard what happened, or you know what I mean? Like that stupid small town crap that she just would have wanted to, like, I don't know, crawl into a hole and die over. I went and sat next to her and we talked about, you know, whose class is your kid going to be in? And I don't know, we just kind of like left it at that. I never said anything. And I think not long after that, she ended up moving back home.
Frankie was glad to see that Rose seemed happy. She had picked up the pieces of her broken family and was moving on from what we can only assume was a horrible experience.
In one of the forums, someone said something about like, oh my God, this guy just, you know, like messed up so many people's lives and he messed up his kids' lives and, you know, not just the victim and their family and friends, like Rufus's friends and family, but also messed up his own family. And someone else commented and said, he probably improved his family situation by removing himself from it.
And I think that person in the forum was right. Rose and her children are way better off without Chris in their lives. It is just such a travesty that he ruined a whole other family's life and took an innocent life in the process.
In today's episode, we delved into a chilling reminder that sometimes our instincts hold more truth than we realize. When someone gives us that uneasy feeling, it's crucial to trust it, because often beneath the surface lies a truth we may not want to see. Just like how Frankie's intuition warned her about Psycho Chris, whose true intentions were far from friendly. It's a lesson we should never forget. Trusting our gut could be the difference between safety and danger. So let's remember to listen to that inner voice. It might just save us from the unknown.
A huge thank you to Frankie for being our first degree guest for today's episode. If you are listening out there and you have a story to tell, please email us hello@thefirstdegreepodcast.com. Follow us on Instagram, join our Facebook group. We're talking true crime all the time. Join our Patreon if you're looking for more first degree content, and stick around tomorrow because we'll have a brand new episode of Killing Time right in your feed.
And remember, only you can prevent serial killers.
And keep your friends close.
But not that close. Shout out to Jared Monaco for scoring original music for The First Degree, producing by Caitlin Cleveland, writing and research by Haley Gray. Sources for this episode are Court Documents, Legacy, WTAW, The Eagle, The Tennessean, and as always, our First Degree guest is always our largest source.
Having a teen feels like having your own live-in influencer. Somehow you know the latest makeup trend and the fact that skinny jeans are not the most flattering pants. Now it's time for you to show them what's up, thanks to Domino's. From April 22nd through April 28th, carry out as many large two-topping pizzas from Domino's as you want for only $6.99 each. And teach your kiddo that saving money and Domino's pizza will never go out of style. Carry out only. You must ask for this limited time offer. Valid 4/22 through 4/28. Tax may apply. Prices, participation, and charges may vary.